headlines, at least three people are killed in a fresh Israeli missile strike near the Syrian capital Damascus. Yemeni officials say Saudi Arabia has seized yet another Yemen-bound fuel ship in violation of the terms of a recent UN-brokered ceasefire. And Russia says the last Ukrainian soldiers in Mariupol's steelworks have surrendered following a week-long siege. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Syria says that its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The report said that the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May 14, killing five Syrian soldiers. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has strongly condemned Israel's repeated violations of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, particularly those targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure. In an address to the UN Security Council, Majid Tahrawanchi also slammed continued Israeli occupation of Syria's Golan Heights. The top Iranian diplomat demanded that the Security Council hold the Israeli regime accountable for such acts of aggression and malice. Dahrawanchi also called for an immediate end to the presence of foreign forces, including American troops, in Syria. He said such a presence has provided a breeding ground for terrorist activities. The Iranian envoy further criticized the, quote, irresponsible, immoral, and illegal unilateral sanctions on Syria. He said the U.S.-led Western bans have impeded Syria's reconstruction efforts and hampered humanitarian aid delivery. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says dozens of Palestinians have been injured in clashes with Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The society says at least 80 Palestinians have been injured in the town of Beita and the village of Beit Dejan in Nablus. The regime forces used rubber bullets and tear gas against anti-Salman protesters. Israeli forces also suppressed a similar weekly protest in the village of Kafkadum. Elsewhere in Masafra Yatta, tens of Palestinians and their foreign supporters suffered breathing difficulties due to inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli troops at a weekly demonstration. Hundreds of Palestinians face imminent risk of forcible displacement from Masafra Yatta, which is designated as a regime as a closed military training site. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says the Palestinian people will no longer wait for Arab regimes or the United Nations to come to their aid in fighting against Israeli occupation.
What happened last year in Al-Quds battle and what happened recently in the last few months, the very strong message that they are sending is that the Palestinian people, that's it. They are no longer waiting for Arab regimes or Arab states or the Arab League or for the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council or UN Security Resolutions. They have decided, they have made up their mind, and today they are ready to go down to the field, to go down to the battle and fight. And I believe that at the minimum, in the last 20 or 30 years, the faith of the majority of the Palestinian people in the choice of resistance is much stronger than any time in the past.
Hezbollah leader said the Nakba Day, when Israeli regime was created, was not only a catastrophe for Palestine, but for all Arab nations in the region. He said the Arab world failed to defend Palestine even when it was strong and united, and therefore it cannot protect Lebanon now. Nasrallah made the remarks on the 6th anniversary of the martyrdom of Hezbollah's top military commander, Sayyid Mustafa Badruddin. He said what protects Lebanon is its people and their resistance. Nasrallah underscored the fact that the resistance in Lebanon will continue relentlessly and will never give up its arms. The Saudi-led coalition has seized another Yemen-bound fuel ship in violation of the terms of a two-month truce brokered by the United Nations. The Yemen Petroleum Company said the ship was denied docking at the port of Hodeidah, even though it had gone through required inspections and obtained clearance from the UN. Asam al-Mutawakkil, a company spokesman, censured the coalition's, quote, act of piracy. He said the coalition had also seized two other ships in the past. Yemen has been reeling from severe fuel shortage and tight siege in Saudi Arabia, and its allies launched a war on the impoverished country in 2015. Russia says it has taken full control of the strategic port of Mariupol after the last remaining Ukrainian fighters holed up in a steel plant put down their arms. Russia's defense ministry says the army has completely liberated the steelworks, which was the last stronghold of the Ukrainian forces in the southern city. According to the ministry, more than 500 Ukrainian forces surrendered to Russian forces on Friday. Russia took over other parts of Mariupol 2 months ago. The city is the largest Russia has captured since it started the war on February 24th. Control over Mariupol helps Russia establish a land corridor from Crimea to eastern Ukraine. Russia's defense minister has pledged, quote, adequate countermeasures against Finland and Sweden's NATO membership. Sergei Shoigu said the two Nordic countries joining NATO have led to an increase in military threats near the border. He said Russia would respond by forming 12 new units in its western military district. Finland and Sweden formally applied to join the Western Military Alliance on Wednesday. One Russian retaliatory measure involves cutting the export of gas. Finnish state-owned energy company says the flow of Russian gas to neighboring Finland will stop on Saturday morning. Gazprom has, however, assured its customers that it will not disrupt the gas transmission network and supplies will continue from other sources in the coming months. An anti-war rally has been held in Rome. People have marched through the city center, demanding the Italian executive in Brussels to halt weapons deliveries to Kiev and seriously commit to a negotiating table aimed at stopping the conflict, Max Civilli reports.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital, calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far too servile. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia, Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv.
The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, the growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
Lawmakers in the European Union have called on EU authorities to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The society has just debated the European Parliament. This atrocity actually has been debated there. Jerome Hughes reports.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemned the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British Home Secretary Priti Patel has branded the anti-Israeli boycott to divestment sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The comments were made during a recent speech at a pro-Israeli lobby group meeting, where she additionally reaffirmed her loyalty to defending Israel. Robert Carter reports.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea has confirmed 219,000 new cases of patients with a fever of unidentified origin, as well as a new death from the illness. The new figures reported by the country's official news agency push the country's total caseload to over 2.5 million and fatalities to nearly 70 in just a week. So far, North Korea has refused to link the fever cases to the COVID-19 pandemic, however, it confirmed last week that at least one of the dead had been diagnosed with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has slammed officials for failure to take practical measures to prevent the outbreak of the virus in a timely manner. Kim has also imposed preventive measures, including quarantines and restrictions on the movement. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you. Early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the U.S., the Justice Department has asked the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for transcripts of interviews it is conducting behind closed doors, including some with associates of former President Donald Trump, according to people with knowledge of the situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Glenn Thrush and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Justice Department is set to request transcripts from January 6th committee. In the U.S., the Justice Department has asked the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for transcripts of interviews it is conducting behind closed doors, including some with associates of former President Donald Trump, according to people with knowledge of the situation. The move is further evidence of the wide-ranging nature of the Justice Department's criminal inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol, and the role played by Donald Trump and his allies as they sought to keep him in office after his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. The House committee, which has no power to pursue criminal charges, has interviewed more than 1,000 people so far, and their transcripts could be used by the Justice Department as evidence in potential criminal cases, to pursue new leads, or as a baseline for new interviews conducted by federal law enforcement officials. Aides to Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and the chair of the House committee have yet to reach a final agreement with the U.S. Justice Department on what will be turned over, according to a person with knowledge of the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the confidential nature of the investigations. On 20th of April, Kenneth Polite Jr., the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Investigation, and Matthew Graves, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, wrote to Timothy J. Heapy, the lead investigator for the House panel, advising him that some committee interviews may contain information relevant to the criminal investigation that we're conducting. Kenneth Polite and Matthew Graves did not indicate the number of transcripts they were requesting or whether any interviews were of particular interest to them. In their letter, they made a broad request asking that the panel provide to us transcripts of those interviews and of any additional interviews you conduct in the future. A person familiar with the matter said the transcripts were part of a negotiation between the House Committee and the Justice Department, in which the panel was hoping that prosecutors would turn over evidence in exchange for the transcripts. These interviews in the possession of the committee are the property of the committee, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the House panel. I imagine that the committee will want to see any relevant evidence used with any relevant legal context. Asked about the Justice Department's request after this article was published, Benny Thompson drew a distinction between handing over the committee's materials and allowing certain documents to be reviewed. He suggested that the panel had invested significant time and effort into conducting so many interviews and was reluctant to simply turn them over. We can't give them full access to our product, he told reporters. That would be premature at this point because we haven't completed our own work. A spokesman for the U.S. Justice Department declined to comment. The department's investigation has been operating on a separate track from the committee's work. Generally, investigators working on the two inquiries have not been sharing information with each other, except for, at times, communicating to ensure that a witness is not scheduled to appear before different investigators at the same time, according to a person with knowledge of the inquiries. Thus far, the Justice Department has prosecuted more than 800 people on charges relating to the storming of the Capitol building. But over the past several months, the department has taken steps to widen its focus substantially to look at the planning for the rally on 6th of January that preceded the riot, while also signaling that its investigation would encompass the broader efforts to overturn the election. And in recent weeks, Attorney General Merrick Garland has bolstered the core team tasked with handling the most sensitive and politically combustible elements of the inquiry. Several months ago, the department quietly detailed a veteran federal prosecutor from Maryland, Thomas Windham, to the department's headquarters. Windham is overseeing the politically fraught question of whether a case can be made related to other efforts to overturn the election, aside from the storming of the Capitol building, That task could move the investigation closer to Donald Trump and to his inner circle. A subpoena reviewed by the New York Times indicates that the Justice Department is exploring the actions taken by rally planners. Prosecutors have begun asking for records about people who organized or people who spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the 2020 election, as well as anyone who provided security at those events, and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. They are also seeking information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the election, as the subpoena put it. The U.S. Justice Department's request for transcripts underscores how much ground the House Committee has covered and the unusual nature of the situation, where a well-staffed congressional investigation has obtained testimony from key witnesses before a grand jury investigation. The committee has signaled that it is considering making a criminal referral of Donald Trump and some of his associates to the Justice Department, a step that could increase the pressure on Merrick Garland to pursue a case. In a ruling in a civil lawsuit filed by the committee, a federal judge found in March of this year that Donald Trump and John Eastman, a lawyer who has advised him on how to overturn the election, most likely had committed felonies, including obstruction, obstructing the work of Congress, and conspiring to defraud the United States. The House Committee, made up of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans, is led by Benny Thompson and Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, one of only 2 House Republicans to embrace an inquiry scrutinizing the actions of their own party. The panel has about 45 employees, including more than a dozen former federal prosecutors and 2 former U.S. attorneys, and it is spending more than $1.6 million per quarter on its work. The committee has obtained documents and testimony from a wide range of witnesses, including more than a dozen Trump White House officials, rally planners, and some of the rioters themselves. Those witnesses have included White House lawyer, Justice Department officials, security officials, members of the National Guard, staff members close to former Vice President Mike Pence, members of Mr. Trump's personal legal team, Republicans who participated in a scheme to put forward pro-Trump electors from states won by Joe Biden Jr., Donald Trump's own family members, and the leaders of right-wing militia groups. At least 16 Trump allies have signaled they will not fully cooperate with the House Committee. Faced with such resistance, investigators on the panel have taken a page out of organized crime prosecutions and have quietly turned at least 6 lower-level Trump administration staff members into witnesses who have provided information about their boss's activities. Some of those witnesses, including an aide to Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff, have provided critical information. The committee also has tried to obtain testimony from Republican members of Congress, and it has issued subpoenas to 5 lawmakers last week. Those members have denigrated the panel's work, but have declined to say whether they would participate in the interviews, which are scheduled for the end of May. One of the lawmakers, Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, said he received a subpoena on Monday and was currently reviewing it. Merrick Garland and his top aides have been careful about not disclosing their investigative methods, and they have sought to emphasize their impartiality in limited public comments about the investigation. We investigate conduct and crimes, not people or viewpoints, the Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco said last week during an interview at the University of Chicago. We follow the evidence, Lisa Monaco said. It is very evident to do that methodically.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. How about pondering upon an excellent piece of advice from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not sit to a table on which there is wine, because no one can guess the very hour in which his soul is grasped.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام عليكم بالدعاء فإن الدعاء لله والطلب إلى الله يرد البلاء وقد قدر وقضي ولم يبق إلا إمضاؤه فإذا دعي الله عز وجل وسئل صرف البلاء صرفه.
إمام الكاظم عليه السلام stated, I urge you to supplicate, for verily supplication to Allah and seeking from Allah repels calamity, which may have been destined and decreed, with just execution remaining. So if Allah is supplicated and is asked to avert a calamity, it is averted.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we look at the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence taught His companions and spoke to His companions about a concept called ad-du'a, supplication. And so in these du'a and these supplications, we find that Imam al-Kadhim teaches his companions in this form of a dialogue on how exactly to pray to Allah and how exactly to address Allah. Now, these du'as in themselves have a very deep and profound meaning as well. In one instance, in this dialogue where Imam al-Kadhim was teaching his companion on how to do dua and what to say in a dua, Imam al-Kadhim, while addressing Allah, says, You, O Allah, know what I conceal, and you, O Allah, know what I make public. In our lives, dear friends, this seems to be one of the great keys to success and prosperity upon our path of Islam. If only we realize and understand that the Almighty Allah knows what we conceal, meaning whatever we think, whatever we have in our hearts, whether it is greed or lust or carnal desires or hate or anger or jealousy, Allah knows it all. And so is it not embarrassing for us to realize that there are these kind of wicked, evil, lowly things in our hearts, and yet Allah is aware of them? And so, of course, we ask for forgiveness from Allah, that may He not only purify these evil characteristics and attributes from our hearts, but may Allah, the Merciful, forgive these faults within our heart. And of course, we as an individual must work hard towards improving these aspects of ourselves. And not only this, when we address the oppressors of the world and the bullies of the world, whether on a local, domestic level, or on a national or even global level, they must remember that Allah knows what is public. Allah knows what is happening, and He is the ultimate judge, and He will surely judge those who do wrong, and He will surely judge those who do right. And Almighty Allah, the Creator of all of existence, will punish those who do wrong, and He will reward all those who do right. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
When you look at the time of the seventh Imam, you know, he also actually lived in the circumstances of taqiyya more than any of the Imams before him. And I'll just give you one example that when it comes to the situation of the seventh Imam, all the Imams who came before, still, they lived at a time where it was possible for them to publicly announce their successor, at least among the Shia community. But by the last days of the sixth Imam, it became so difficult. And this is amazing that now you have Banu Abbas. The Hashimid rulers are there, not Umayyads. But they were more cruel in a way. Things have become so bad that the sixth Imam realized that if we disclose who is my heir and successor publicly, you know, Banu Abbas, they are actually looking for who will be my successor, and they will eliminate him. So what Imam did was, besides, you know, talking to his old close companions and letting them know about our seventh Imam, he actually wrote a will which was to be opened and publicly pronounced so everybody would know about it. And that's where you see our sixth Imam uses what we call Tawriya.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tries to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Tehran International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rock hopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile
to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.